surprising for them. But more importantly, where was this water coming from? The issue of this bottled water, talk about it.
Amy, this is unreal. So the same week that the state granted Nestle this permit for $200 a year for unlimited access, essentially, to the Great Lakes, was the same week that they cut bottled water for Flint. There are people in Flint who still cannot afford water. They are, to this day, getting shutoffs because they cannot pay their bills for water that they still need to use a filter to drink from. And we grant a corporation unlimited access to the Great Lakes water. It is mind-boggling. It is tone-deaf. It is unreal for this to happen.
Flint, Michigan pediatrician Dr. Mona Hanna-Attisha, her new book, What the Eyes Don't See, A Story of Crisis, Resistance, and Hope in an American City. If you'd like to go back to the documentary we did in Flint when we were there during the height of the crisis, you can go to democracynow.org and put into search Thirsty for Democracy, The Poisoning of an American City. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Has a job opening for a broadcast engineer. Check our website at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton. I'm Amy Goodman.
Good afternoon. The time is 5 o'clock, and you are listening to KBOO Portland. And up next is the KBOO Evening News.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Engineering Committee will meet on the first Wednesday at 7 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Onion Music Festival starting July 28th at Sunnyside Outdoor Event Space in Washougal, Washington. The Onion Music Festival features a three-day lineup of musicians, artists, installations, and vendors. Performers include the fabulous Downey Brothers, The Fur Coat, Night Heron, Adebisi, and many more. This is an 18 and over event with no dogs allowed. Again, that's the Onion Music Festival, July 28th and 29th at Sunnyside Outdoor Event Space, 30303 Northeast 10th Street in Washougal, Washington. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon Governor candidate Newt Bueller opposes sanctuary states.
Papa John to sue his former company.
And a Swedish student stops a plane to prevent a deportation.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, July 26th, 2018. I'm Tom.
And I'm Grace Ann Smith. Oregon has some of the most stunning river scenery in the country. In conjunction with the KBOO reporter CJ Fritz and the Oregon News Service, we have more on the protections designated for our wild river areas.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lazarowitz, and this is Climate Connections.
A rally is scheduled for tonight, 5:30 p.m. to 6:30 p.m. in support of public services that are facing budget cuts, office closures, and privatization. The action is hosted by Portland Community, Postal Workers United, Portland Area American Postal Workers Union, and Portland Jobs with Justice. It will take place at the main post office, 715 Northwest Hoyt in Portland. The organizers chose tonight because it's Postal Heritage Day and the 243rd anniversary of the U.S. Post Office, whose first postmaster was Ben Franklin. Organizers assert that the Trump administration has launched an attack on the Postal Service. On June 21st, the White House issued a proposal, Delivering Government Solutions in the 21st Century, which called for the privatization of the People's Postal Service. The proposal would reduce the USPS obligation to provide universal service, deliver fewer days of the week, eliminate at-the-door and curbside delivery, sell and close post offices and processing plants, as well as eliminate labor protections and reduce wages and benefits for postal workers. Confirmed speakers tonight for the action are John Marcotte and Joe Kogan from APWU, Dave Norton from NALC, Tom Chamberlain from OR Oregon AFL-CIO, Alyssa Pagan from Jobs with Justice, and more. Information can be found on Facebook by searching Rally for Public Services.
And sorry about that. We lost some audio for a moment, but this is about more about Oregon's river scenery.
The Wild and Scenic Rivers Act turns 50 this year. Conservation groups are praising the law and want to see more of the United States' iconic waterways protected. Oregon is home to the most rivers with wild and scenic designations. They include the Rogue River, one of the original eight rivers to receive the designation in 1968. More than 80 miles of the Rogue are protected, keeping the river free-flowing in its natural state. Amy Kober with American Rivers, speaking from the Rogue River's banks, says it's special.
It has the most fun whitewater, it has the most stunning scenery, the most gorgeous campsites, and the history here, too, from the Native Americans to the gold miners and the settlers. There's no other river like the Rogue.
Local Bureau of Land Management officials say current protections are enough to preserve the Rogue. Close to 13,000 miles of river are kept free-flowing through wild and scenic designations nationwide. Conservation groups such as American Rivers and companies including REI are campaigning to protect 5,000 new miles of river, including waterways in the Owyhee Canyonlands and Oregon wildlands. Equally important for many of these groups is giving people access to these waters. Luke Argleben is with the Hispanic Access Foundation, which gives outdoor opportunities to underserved Latino communities. He says, once you expose kids to a river, the river tends to do the rest.
It's actually one of my favorite aspects of this job is to watch them fall in love and get that spark in their eye. And they go back to their communities and they share their stories and they say, hey, look, there's this awesome place, let's go. We create advocates, we create stewards.
But David Morick with American Rivers says the Rogue River faces threats, including climate change and nearby logging operations. He also notes that while the river itself is protected, many of its tributaries are not. Morick says those tributaries are important for salmon, providing cold water when the river heats up.
It's kind of a refuge for those baby and adult salmon. And so there'd be no more fitting legacy for the Rogue than for us to protect more of its wildlands and the tributaries that sort of give it life.
In conjunction with Oregon News Service and for KBOO's Evening News, I'm CJ Fritz.
Yesterday, the United States District Court in Oregon issued a ruling by dismissal stating that schools are not only permitted but are required to treat transgender students equally under the law. The ruling stemmed from a lawsuit filed last November in the Dallas School District by a small group of parents and students through organizations such as Parents for Privacy and Parents' Rights in Education. In the lawsuit, parents and students claimed that policies allowing transgender students to use restrooms and lockers aligned with their gender identity was in violation of their right to privacy. The ACLU intervened in the suit and requested a dismissal earlier this year. The precedent follows in the footsteps of other courts in the U.S. who are rejecting similar lawsuits. Despite this victory, another lawsuit in Sutherland, Oregon, concerning the rights of transgender individuals using bathrooms aligned with their gender, is targeting a specific transgender student. The ACLU has also become involved in this lawsuit. Other organizations that have been involved in the fight for transgender students' rights has been Fierce Families and Basic Rights Oregon. Nancy Hack, Haik of the Basic Rights Oregon's executive director said in a statement, "We will continue to defend transgender youth in our schools and push back against any future lawsuits. No matter how many attacks we see on our community, we are not backing down."
Representative Newt Bueller, currently running for governor against the incumbent Governor Kate Brown, has publicly announced his opposition to Oregon's status as a sanctuary state. The current sanctuary law prohibits the use of state resources to aid in any federal immigration enforcement. According to the Willamette Week, on Monday, Bueller announced his intention to repeal the law on a conservative talk show hosted by Lars Larson. Oregon has maintained a sanctuary state law for over 30 years, but with the issue of immigration becoming more divisive under President Trump, the state's policy is now coming under scrutiny from the Republican candidate. Measure 105, which would repeal Oregon's sanctuary state law, was recently certified by the Oregon Secretary of State for having collected enough signatures to be put on a vote on the November ballot. Bueller voted against maintaining the sanctuary law last year when he was a representative in the Oregon legislature. The bill he voted against was supported by Governor Brown. Bueller has done plenty of work to maintain himself as a moderate, especially concerning abortion rights. Despite his efforts, Bueller's stance on Oregon's sanctuary law marks the second time in only 3 weeks that he has taken a deeply conservative position on a state issue. Previously, Bueller celebrated President Trump's pardon of the Hammonds, who were sentenced for arson, a decision which sparked the Malheur occupation in eastern Oregon.
Measure 105, the measure that proposes rescinding Oregon's existing sanctuary law, has qualified for the November election. This Saturday, July 28th, from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. at CAUSA in Portland office located at 3645 Southeast 32nd Avenue in Portland, for the Oregonians United Against Profiling, is hosting an action and kickoff of their campaign to defeat Measure 105. Multiple events will follow across the state to mobilize local communities. If you'd like to join in, visit orunited.org. That's orunited.org.
In a rally planned for this weekend, supporters of improved, expanded Medicare for All are gathering to ask Senator Ron Wyden to sign Senate Bill 1804, the Medicaid for All Act of 2017. The bill currently has 16 co-sponsors that include Senator Merkley. In addition, the action will also be asking Senator Wyden to co-sponsor Senate version of H.R. 6097, the state-based Universal Care Act of 2018. The act amends the Affordable Care Act and lays the foundations for what advocates say will be a stable health care system in Oregon. Speakers at the event will be David Young from Health Care for All Oregon and Lisa Stiller from the Democratic Party of Oregon Health Care Caucus. The rally takes place this Friday at 11 a.m. outside the entrance to Park Rose High School at 2300 Northeast Shave Street in Portland.
Earlier this morning, a man attempted to jump from an overpass to an I-5 near the I-84 interchange. The Portland police intervened, talking with the man. The man in question was discovered to have been going through a mental health crisis. Law enforcement then contacted the crisis negotiation team to resolve the issue. Traffic will still be moving through, but backed up at the time.
KGW did a report on Velana Colon, a mom of three young kids who's on a mission to transform the sports drink aisle. Colon spent years formulating a healthy, organic sports drink for kids called K-Plus that just hit the shelves at New Season stores in Oregon and others in Southern California. Colon says she started to get smarter about looking at the ingredients in the neon colors of the big drinks like Gatorade and Powerade. She started searching for an alternative. She began with coconut water, playing around with ingredients like organic cane sugar, potassium for electrolytes, and purified sea salt. She knew she had something when her kids said they loved it. She hired a professional food lab to get the formula perfect and certified organic. At 14 grams, K-Plus has less than half the amount of sugar that other sports drinks. A 20-ounce bottle of Gatorade, for example, has 34 grams of sugar. LeBron James' wife, Savannah James, just became a co-founding partner with Cologne and has hit social media announcing her signature lemonade flavor K+. Now these women are ready to take on the biggest names in the beverage industry. You can find K+ at New Seasons stores or buy it online.
The Oregonian says shared electronic scooters are now in place in downtown Portland, ready for riders. Bird scooters, which have a downloadable app to locate them, are the first of e-scooters to appear on the streets. Remember, you must wear a helmet riding these things because it's the law. Oregonian writes the Bird scooters are now available as far south as Southeast 50th Avenue and on Foster Road, and as far north as Killingsworth and Burridge Avenue. The scooters cost $1 to unlock and 15 cents a minute to ride. Bird announced in a press release Thursday that the company would be giving away helmets in Pioneer Courthouse Square between 10 a.m. and 1 p.m. on Thursday. The Oregonian says in the release, Bird said it will abide by its industry-leading Saving Our Sidewalks pledge. Bird says it commits to collecting all of its vehicles each night for charging and necessary maintenance, practicing a responsible growth by only adding more vehicles when each Bird averages 3 or more rides per day, and remitting $1 per vehicle per day to the city to build more bike lanes, promote safe riding, and maintain shared infrastructure. Some rules to go by when riding the scooters are wearing a helmet, riding in bicycle lanes or a vehicle lane, making sure to walk scooters on the sidewalk and park scooters with care on the sidewalk by the curb. Do not ride scooters on the sidewalk. And have fun.
John Schnatter, the former face and CEO of Papa John's, is filing a lawsuit against his former pizza chain company. Schnatter recently got in trouble in May for using the N-word in a conference call exercise with Laundry Service, a marketing company, complaining that Colonel Sanders, the face of KFC, could use the word and never received any reprimand. Although he used the slur, Schnatter claims he would never use the slur himself. Schnatter resigned after the incident, but he's now seeking to file the lawsuit for not having the company investigate the incident and instead believing rumors. The company itself is trying to prevent Schnatter from gaining control, as Schnatter owns 29% of the Papa John's stock.
The senior living community known as Friendship Village in St. Louis, Missouri has refused to house a lesbian couple. Your request to share a single unit does not fall within the categories permitted by the long-standing policy of Friendship Village Sunsets, was quoted from a letter sent to 72-year-old Mary Walsh and 68-year-old Bev Nance, the couple who applied and put down a $2,000 deposit to live there. While touring the senior living community, the couple had asked if it was acceptable for a same-sex couple to share the same living quarters. The guy looked at me like I had three heads and said, "No, we don't have any problem at all." He looked at me so strangely, I never asked the question again, quotes theadvocate.com. Friendship Village's cohabitation policy characterizes marriage as something that is only heterosexual between a man and a woman. The couple decided to take this situation to court, where the National Center for Lesbian Rights and the American Civil Liberties Union is now representing them in a case where the Senior Living Center has violated the Fair Housing Act and also discriminated against the couple's sexual orientation. However, according to advocate.com, the couple might not be able to be protected by laws or policies, since Friendship Village is its own private entity and can choose to decline applicants out of freedom of association, even if the case is very strong.
Someone drove by the front of a local Florida gay bar shouting, "Do you want to be gay?" at a group of gay men before throwing eggs at them. The men were egged so hard that bystanders were also splattered in the incident. Although this seems like an isolated incident, a thrift shop and law enforcement station were also egged. As a lighthearted redemption, the owner of the gay bar then announced that they would be having egg salad sandwiches as a special on Wednesday.
We have an update of the demise of Trump's Hollywood star. Early on Wednesday morning, Austin Kleay allegedly vandalized Trump's star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. Clay, 24, arrived at the site of the vandalism just after 3 in the morning and removed a pickaxe from a guitar case before destroying the star. Clay later turned himself into the Los Angeles Police Department, who charged him with felony vandalism. Vandalism of Trump's Walk of Fame star has become somewhat commonplace since he was elected president. Clay was being held with bail set at $20,000. According to Vice, Clay was bailed out by an all-too-fitting friend. The man who bailed out Clay out of jail, James Otis, is the same man who also vandalized Trump's star 2 years ago. Otis's weapon of choice was also a pickaxe, though Otis used a sledgehammer as well during his escapade. As soon as Clay is officially released, Otis apparently plans to meet with his fellow vandal. Despite being bailed out, Clay still faces up to 3 years in prison, but if he takes a page out of Otis's book, he may plead no contest in favor of probation, community service, and a hefty fine. And now it's time for your daily dose of labor history in two from host Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1877. That was the day striking railroad workers in Chicago clashed with police in the Battle of the Halsted Street Viaduct. The Great Railroad Strike had reached the nation's railroad hub and began there 3 days earlier. Switchmen from the Michigan Central traveled to freight shops in yards across the city, calling workers out to strike. Soon, lumber shovers, butchers, and industrial workers joined the strike. By the time the battle began, police had already clashed with unarmed strikers twice. Historian Richard Schneveroff describes the scene leading up to the battle. The city was now preparing itself for a full-scale insurrection, even though violent confrontations were rooted in police attacks on non-violent crowds. Previous confrontations centered in the railroad yards. Now, striker actions spilled over into the neighborhood of Pilsen, where they live. Thousands gathered along Halsted Street between 12th and 16th Streets. The police arrived attempting to disperse the crowd. They chased the strikers south and, as Schneeroff describes, emptied their revolvers into the masses of humanity. The crowd pelted the police with stones in defense and chased them over the viaduct. As word spread of the pitched battle, stockyard workers from nearby Bridgeport walked off the job. They marched along Halsted Street with butcher knives in hand to support the strikers under attack. The crowd on Halsted swelled to more than 10,000 as workers continued to battle police. By evening, 30 workers had been shot dead. Hundreds more were seriously wounded. But the strike continued to spread more fiercely. Streetcar stockmen, stonecutters, gas workers, glass cutters, and others joined the strike. The city was shut down for another week until railroad bosses finally rescinded wage cuts. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
And now it's time for the news in everything water-related from our friends at H2O Radio.
Can't think straight? Grab a glass of water. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
The interim head of the EPA, Andrew Wheeler, signed new rules last week that relax requirements for handling toxic waste from the burning of coal. The resulting ash has contaminated waterways and groundwater from Virginia to Alaska.
Wheeler's action comes after utilities resisted regulations passed during the Obama administration. The Guardian reports that before he became EPA administrator, Wheeler worked as a lobbyist for Murray Energy, which supported reconsideration of the Obama coal ash rules. He said the move will save power companies about $30 million a year.
But environmentalists argue that the lessening of standards endangers the health of those who live near coal ash storage sites or power plants. The head of the Sierra Club's Beyond Coal campaign said they will oppose the rollback every step of the way.
The new standards do allow states to set their own more stringent coal ash safeguards, such as those set in North Carolina, where Duke Energy paid a large fine after a coal ash spill in 2014.
In other EPA developments, Conference, the agency held a hearing last week about its proposal to drastically limit the scientific studies it considers in shaping human health protections.
The Associated Press reports that if adopted, the new rule would allow EPA to reject a study if the underlying data, such as private patient medical records, is not made public.
A study such as that done by Harvard Public Health nearly 30 years ago that established links between death rates and dirty air in cities could be rejected if the new rule is accepted because it doesn't reveal confidential patient information.
Paul Tomko, a Democratic congressman from New York, said the new rule is a thinly veiled attempt to reject research that supports critical regulatory action.
The city of Baltimore filed suit on Friday against 26 fossil fuel companies to hold them financially accountable for threats to the city's waterfront from sea level rise.
Inside Climate News reports that Baltimore wants compensation and is also seeking damages because the companies misled the public about the effects of burning fossil fuels.
Baltimore's case was filed less than a day after a federal judge threw out New York City's similar effort, saying that while climate change is a fact of life not contested by fossil fuel companies, the courts are not the branch of government to fix the problem. His ruling followed that of another judge in California who tossed similar claims by San Francisco and Oakland.
In contrast, Baltimore's case, like some others, is brought in state court, not federal. Some legal scholars say that they may have better chances in front of state judges.
Meanwhile, 9 suits filed by or on behalf of children are still pending against governmental entities, claiming they must address and prevent the consequences of climate change on land, water, and the atmosphere.
Speaking of young people, on Saturday, July 21st, youth activists across the globe engaged in marches and demonstrations as a part of the Zero Hour movement that focuses on climate change and environmental justice. Speakers called on elected officials to reject money from fossil fuel companies, ban all new dirty energy developments, and safeguard the planet for future generations.
Fish are having a tough time not far from the southwestern town of Durango, Colorado. About 300 were saved on Wednesday from the deadly runoff caused by the large 416 wildfire, but thousands in the Animas River have already been killed.
The Durango Herald reports that the burn area recently received needed precipitation, but it brought down ash and dirt into the river, suffocating fish.
Besides these problems, the Animas River has been experiencing extremely low flows, down to about 200 cubic feet per second from the usual 1,000 at this time of year.
The low flows and higher water temperatures also stress fish. Cold water species like trout, as well as aquatic insects, are affected by heat and lower flows because the dissolved oxygen content in the water drops.
The same aquatic suffering is occurring in New Mexico, where drought is ravaging the state. The Taos News reports that anglers are being asked to go out earlier in the morning, higher in the mountains, and not fish after noon.
The record-setting heat this summer has spurred a movement to protect those who work outside, particularly farm and construction workers. On Tuesday, a coalition of 130 public health and environmental groups submitted a petition to OSHA that would require employers to provide their workers with water, access to shady or cooled spaces, and mandatory breaks.
From 1992 to 2016, heat killed 783 workers in the U.S. and seriously injured nearly 70,000, according to a study by the consumer advocacy group Public Citizen. And that number is likely understated because workers fear retaliation and some even deportation if they complain.
Inside Climate News reports that right now, employers must provide workplaces that are free of hazards, but the coalition said employers are falling short. Specific heat-related rules are necessary as global warming leads to hot spells and record temperatures. And while heat can be serious for workers, just being dehydrated can affect a person's ability to think.
According to a new study by the Georgia Institute of Technology, cognitive functions wilt as water leaves the body, researchers found a strong correlation between dehydration and the ability to focus, coordinate, and problem solve. They say that could raise the risk of an accident, particularly in settings that combine heavy sweating and dangerous machinery.
So, how much water do you have to lose to affect concentration? About 2% of body mass, according to the lead investigator. For example, a 200-pound person could lose 4 pounds of water during an hour of moderate activity at a temperature in the mid-80s.
So when you're feeling a little foggy, even when sitting at your desk, go for that water bottle. It might save you from sending an email or a report with an embarrassing typo.
This Week in Water is supported by the American Water Works Association, highlighting the latest cost-effective strategies to manage aging infrastructure at the Water Infrastructure Conference and Expo, October 28th to 31st in Atlanta. Learn more at awwa.org/H2O Infocon.
It won't do to dream of caramel, think of cinnamon and long for you. It won't do.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for our in-depth. We will be listening to part two of Making Contact's piece on Afrofuturism. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, it's the Indigenous Power Hour, followed at 8 by FBL Radio. Tonight's weather, we'll reach a high of around 96 degrees, followed by cooler temperatures in the low 60s tonight. East of the Cascades and Hood River, highs will be in the upper 90s. Today in history, Aldous Huxley was born in the year 1894. He wrote the great dystopian novel Brave New World and went on to write books such as The Doors of Perception, which documented his experiences with hallucinogenic drugs. The quote of the day is from Aldous Huxley. Fanaticism, defined in our psychological terms, a fanatic is a man who consciously overcompensates a secret doubt.
So goodbye, sweet appetite, no single bite.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Perry Bellegarde has been reelected as the National Chief of Canada's largest Native organization, the Assembly of First Nations. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, the election itself was not without controversy, and Bellegarde faced some sharp criticism.
It took two ballots before Perry Bellegarde was declared the winner. He took 328 of the 522 votes. He will now serve his second three-year term as National Chief. Bellegarde is from the Little Black Bear First Nation in Saskatchewan. After the election, Bellegarde said the AFN's strong voice has meant positive changes for Indigenous communities across Canada, and that will continue.
Better housing, better education, better health care, and yes, lands and resources coming back to First Nations people, because we know it's assumed Crown sovereignty.
But Bellegarde's critics say he has been too cozy with the federal government and was too soft on the issue of the Trans Mountain Pipeline expansion, which many Native groups continue to oppose. That project would triple the amount of Alberta oil flowing west towards the British Columbia coast. One of Bellegarde's challengers also claimed federal interference because the federal Minister of Indigenous Relations was at the convention during the vote. But Carolyn Bennett says she was invited to listen to regional concerns, and at no point did she discuss the election. Bellegarde says he will spend the next 3 years with the goal of improving the quality of life for Indigenous peoples, also addressing the high rates of youth suicide, and getting more resources for the 40,000 First Nations children in foster care. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
A man facing rape charges in New Mexico has been arrested in Phoenix, the Santa Fe New Mexican reports. A warrant was issued this week for 41-year-old Red Wolf Pope following an investigation that he allegedly secretly recorded himself sexually assaulting unconscious women. Pope, an attorney and businessman, describes himself as a Native American activist and splits time living between Santa Fe and Seattle. The district attorney's office will work on extraditing him back to New Mexico. Some Native Americans in New Mexico plan to stage their own celebration during the time once reserved for a controversial reenactment parade in Santa Fe. The action comes after organizers of the Entrada announced this week they're canceling the portrayal of Spanish conquistadors commemorating their return to the city after the 1680 Pueblo Revolt. The event drew protests from Pueblo people, including Jennifer Marley, who says she's pleased the Entrada is canceled but says there's more to do.
I don't think we could say that anything has been reconciled just yet. This is just the beginning of a long line of victories that I think are in store if people continue to protest injustices that happen here.
Marley was arrested and charged with a felony at last year's protest. The charges were later dropped. The Navajo Tribal Council's Law and Order Committee approved legislation this week to request the Indian Health Service to assign medical staff to all correctional facilities on the reservation. Lawmakers in support of the bill want to improve health care of inmates at federally funded facilities on Navajo land and say this is an ongoing issue. There are no medical staff at any of the facilities. Officers have to transfer inmates to local IHS or other health centers for services and emergencies. Health care is not provided by the federal government to tribal jails. The Native American Heritage Fund has selected three projects in Michigan to receive its first ever grants. More than $400,000 will go to the removal of offensive Indian imagery at schools, a city hall, and a park. The board hopes to help projects that promote positive relationships and accurate information about Michigan's tribes. Six other applications are being considered. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The Public News Service is a member-supported media outlet that aims to keep the news honest. Here's today's roundup.
The Public News Service Daily Newscast for Thursday, July the 26, 2018. I'm Mike Clifford. GOP members of the House file articles of impeachment against Deputy AG Rod Rosenstein. Also on the Thursday rundown, health advocates cheer as the feds reverse course on health care payments, and NASA is using Chesapeake Bay pollution research for satellites. First, our top story, Politico reports House conservatives filed articles of impeachment in an effort to oust Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, the overseer of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation. Politico adds the articles filed late Wednesday by Representatives Mark Meadows and Jim Jordan, two top allies of President Trump, blast Rosenstein for what they allege was a failure to respond to congressional documents demands. Senior Justice Department officials told Politico they rejected that criticism and described historic levels of cooperation with Congress, sharing files connected to the FBI investigations of Hillary Clinton's email server and Trump campaign contacts with Russia. Meantime, the Trump administration is restarting a part of the Affordable Care Act that it slashed 2 weeks ago. Suzanne Potter reports that comes much to the relief of insurers and healthcare advocacy groups.
The feds announced Tuesday that they will allow risk adjustment payments from 2017 to go through after blocking them in early July. The program collects money from health plans that have mostly healthy patients and distributes it to health plans that take on older, sicker patients. Sean Greminger with the nonprofit Families USA says it is crucial to ensure access to health care for everyone.
It's critical that this was put in place and that it stay in place because it really is the mechanism that allows health plans to provide coverage to people with pre-existing conditions.
Earlier this year, a judge in New Mexico questioned the fairness of the program's formulas and asked for clarification. Now the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services has released an interim final rule that rectifies the problems raised in that case.
And if Obamacare, otherwise known as the Affordable Care Act, is imploding, don't tell Texas, Eric Galatis explains.
Despite confusion over recent congressional efforts to repeal the Affordable Care Act, shorter enrollment periods, and reduced advertising and outreach, the overall number of Texans with health coverage is on the rise, according to a new report by the Episcopal Health Foundation. Brian Sasser with the foundation says 90% of Texans with active ACA health plans currently receive federal subsidies to help lower their premium costs.
When you talk about people who actually signed up for a plan
and then paid their premium in 2018, there's actually more people in Texas now who have active Affordable Care Act health insurance in 2018 than they did just 1 year ago.
Sasser says 9 out of 10 Texans who signed up for ACA coverage during open enrollment last fall activated their plan in 2018. Last year, just 78% of Texas enrollees activated plans. As a result, Sasser says the ACA now provides affordable health coverage for more than 1 million Texans.
Texas is one of 20 states that opted not to expand Medicaid coverage under the Affordable Care Act and has the highest uninsured rate in the nation. The Montana Human Rights Network says groups opposed to Native American rights need to be labeled as hate groups. Here's Eric Tegedoff.
In a follow-up to its 2000 study, Drumming Up Resentment, the anti-Indian movement in Montana, the network released a report saying these groups deserve the designation from national organizations, the media, and the American public. Travis McAdam with the network says groups may be evading designation as hate groups because the movement typically is localized and not every state contains tribal nations, keeping them out of the national spotlight. He says in Montana, anti-Native American groups tend to mobilize when tribes take action to assert their legal sovereignty.
Then a lot of times you see this organized backlash where you start to see both established anti-Indian groups and then sometimes more kind of local-based opposition pop up.
McAdam says Montana groups such as the Citizens Equal Rights Alliance fit the Southern Poverty Law Center's definition of a hate group by attacking or maligning a class of people. The alliance says it isn't a hate group and that its goal is to defend the constitutional rights of both Native and non-Native people.
McAdam says this movement often paints Native Americans as a people of the past, clouding the perception of tribes as they exist today and making it harder to discuss some of the modern challenges they face. And finally, Tramell Gomes tells us this summer researchers used Chesapeake Bay as a testing location to better understand air pollution over water.
Researchers have conducted extensive studies on air pollution and smog on land, but looking at air pollution over water and at a vertical level presents challenges. That's why this summer researchers chose Hart Miller Island in Chesapeake Bay as a firm place to study air pollution on and above the coast. In addition to determining what happens to the emissions of power plants, cars, and other pollutants, the studies also will have an expanded use, according to John Sullivan, a research scientist at NASA's Goddard Space and Light Center.
We're also moving into a regime here in NASA where we'll be launching an air quality satellite that will be able to provide much more information spatially and temporally.
Sullivan says the results of the data gathered will be useful to the satellite with modeling and in other ways, since the technology also has difficulties looking for pollution gradients on the coast.
Now that the study is complete at the bay, Sullivan says the group will look to accomplish another full observation next year with an area around Long Island Sound. I'm Mike Clifford. Thanks for News and Cruising with Public News Service. We are member and listener supported, and we're online at publicnewsservice.org.
Guardia Civil, a unit of Spanish law enforcement, clashed with nearly 800 sub-Saharan African migrants earlier this morning. According to CNN.com, the migrants stormed a fence to the country's northern African enclave of Ceuta from Morocco. The migrants were equipped with sticks, stones, containers of fecal matter, and quicklime, used aerosol cans as flamethrowers against the police. Around 600 migrants breached the fence, and around 580 were held in a migrant holding center. Several migrants were injured during the breach, and a small handful were taken into hospital care. Of the officers defending against the breach, 16 were injured and 4 were taken to the hospital.
Ellen Ersson, a Swedish student, had stopped a plane heading to Istanbul from Gothenburg, Sweden, in order to prevent an Afghan man from being deported. Ersson began a Facebook live broadcast where she stood up before the flight and announced to passengers and airline employees, quote, "There is a man who is going to get deported to Afghanistan, where he will most likely get killed," end quote. "I'm not going to sit down until this person is off the plane." Many passengers and airline employees began to get aggravated with Ersson as she was holding up the flight. Some were also in support. Eventually, Ersson and the Afghan man were escorted off the plane. A spokesperson from the Swedish West Region Law Enforcement told CNN that the man being deported was a forced deportation.
Nigeria Air, has made its debut, making it the newest airline flag carrier for Nigeria in 15 years. 15 years ago, Nigeria had a state-funded airline known as Nigerian Airways, but it shut down. While Nigerians are excited for the new airline, many are skeptical of the government running the operation due to its previous shutdown. Nigeria has had many attempts at creating airlines, all of which have been unable to stay in business. The Nigerian government will have limited responsibility for Nigeria Air and will only own around 5% of the airline, while private investors will make sure it stays functional. According to CNN, the Nigerian government will not have any input in who operates the airline.
The longest lunar eclipse of the 21st century is coming up, and you don't want to miss it. On Friday, the moon will be fully engulfed in the heart of the Earth's shadow for 1 hour and 42 minutes and 57 seconds. It doesn't get much better than that. The longest possible duration of the lunar eclipse is 1 hour and 47 minutes, according to the earthsky.org. If you live in North America, you will not be able to see the marathon event in person unless you live in the far eastern part of Newfoundland. Unfortunately, the event will be occurring during the daytime. If you live in the Eastern South America, Europe, Africa, and the Middle East, Asia, or Australia, you're in luck. The rest of us will just have to watch online. Even though the Earth will be lined up directly between the Moon and the Sun, the Moon won't be blacked out completely. If you were standing on the Moon at the time of the eclipse, the Earth would look like a black disk outlined in glowing red. That's because some light from the Sun bends around the edge of the Earth, with the blue and the green wavelengths scattered by our atmosphere. The moon is taking almost the longest possible path through the Earth's shadow. The shortest eclipse of the century occurred just 3 years ago on April 4th in 2015. It lasted for four minutes and 43 seconds. Even if you can't see Friday night's eclipse in real life, you can watch it on your computer. The website timeanddate.com will be live streaming the eclipse beginning at 11 a.m. PDT Friday.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is C.J. Fritz, Summer Barraza, and Lucas Campbell. The producer is Grace Ann Smith. Our engineer and the KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zelos Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available at our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Tom, and this is my last day of doing the news here at KBOO. I'll miss this place, and I'll always be grateful to my mentors here and to you, KBOO's loyal listeners and supporters. Thank you all.
And I'm Grace Ann Smith, and if you are just as bummed out as I am about Tom leaving, I have a small silver lining to offer you. Coming up tomorrow on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Positively Revolting, Ani takes your calls. At 9, One Land, Many Voices presents excerpts from the Winnipeg Talk addressing the relocation of the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem. At 10, Valley Views relays personal tales of how black women who look nothing alike are often mistaken for each other. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, it's Pacific Underground, a show for and by Asian Pacific Islanders in the Northwest. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate.
Bye, Tom. We'll miss you so much. Happy trails.
Thank you.
Too much. Thank you.
Cable News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
On tonight's In Depth, it's part two of Making Contact's Afrofuturism segment. Part one featured Black authors Nado Hopkinson, Nnedi Okorafor, and Jewel Gomez talking about the healing aspects of rediscovering one's own Black heritage in a forward-thinking narrative and about the role of African diaspora in the future. Part two has the authors talking about the monsters that inspired their Afrofuturism stories.
You're listening to Afrofuturist authors on Making Contact. Nado Hopkinson is the author of 9 books, from Brown Girl in the Ring to the Nebula Award-winning Sister Mine. Nnedi Okorafor writes African-based science fiction for both children and adults, including the Nebula and Hugo Award-winning Binti series and Akata Warrior. And Jewel Gomez is a writer, activist, and the author of the Double Lambda Award-winning novel, The Gilda Stories. Her dream play, Waiting for Giovanni, is about James Baldwin. For more information about these authors, visit the Making Contact website, radioproject.org, where you'll also find past episodes. You can sign up for news about upcoming shows, like us on Facebook, or follow us on Twitter at @making_contact. You can also find us on Instagram at Making Contact Radio Project. Please rate us on iTunes. It helps other people find us. Now let's rejoin the conversation as our three authors discuss the monsters that have captured their imagination and what they hope to see in the future of Afrofuturism.
I'm sitting here trying to figure out why this monster is so central to so many of my stories. There are two. One of them is Godzilla. And this is why I'm sitting here trying to figure out, okay, because Godzilla has shown up in many of my stories in various ways. And I know that if someone were to just ask me without intellectualizing it, why do I like Godzilla, it's Godzilla's destructive nature. Godzilla comes out of the water and just destroys. There's no rhyme or reason. He just comes out, destroys everything, and then goes back into the water. I love that. I don't know why. I don't know why. There's something about it. And it may have something to do with my obsession with post-apocalyptic narratives as well. Okay. This idea of everything being destroyed, you know, and then having to deal with that. Mm-hmm. It also may have to do with my anger issues. I don't know.
Get it somewhere. All right.
A lot of rage. The second monster, it's not really a monster. It's just this entity that has shown up consistently in my works now. It's in Lagoon, and it's in Akata Witch Part 2 as well. And it's this spider. It's this giant spider that is, its name is Udide, which means spider in Igbo. The first time the idea of the spider showed up in one of my stories, it was in my story called Spider the Artist, which deals with the Niger Delta, where you've got like these, it's set in the near future, where you have these, the government and the oil companies have created these robot spiders to guard the pipelines, the oil pipelines in Nigeria, can prevent people from bunkering. And these spiders, of course, they kill anyone who touches them. They just tear them to shreds so that they can guard the oil. So that's sort of another story. But this spider is not Anansi. I know that. I'm terrified of spiders. I don't know why. It's an irrational fear. And so spiders have always shown up in my stories, but this particular large one, it lives underneath the city of Lagos, and it turns onto its back and feels the vibrations of the people. Mm-hmm. And it's a monstrous spider, and it weaves and creates stories and narrative and controls everything. It's just, yeah. So that's my second spider. Yeah, I'll stop there.
Okay, so I want to stop and read that story like right now.
Yeah.
What? Okay.
Well, I guess my monster started out as those two guys on the street. And has evolved to any figures that prey upon people who are less, powerful.
Right.
And I think that was one of the reasons I was interested in doing vampire stories, because Dracula is such a pervasive mythology, such a pervasive character, and insidious because he's charming, and he's a serial killer.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you go back to the original ones, that he, seduces women and kills them. And everybody is, like, excited. Dracula's coming over, you know. I'm like,
is it?
So that really fascinated me, that people would find this such a romantic figure in such a predatory figure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I remember one day I went with my mother and grandmother to see the play Dracula on Broadway. We left that and went to see the movie with Frank Langella, which was playing in Times Square.
Same time.
And we were in conversation about that for hours. Like, how could he be so sexy and be such a killer?
Right.
So that really set me up to work on how to redo the mythology so that I felt like a vampire could be heroic and not a predator, not a serial killer. And in this new book that I'm working on, it's about the society becoming predatory, using people who are empathic, using people who have certain kinds of skills, artistic skills, and making them work for the government, segregating them into patches so they only associate with people who are doing what they do, and how to escape that. So it really is, the monster is really is those who prey on less powerful people.
It is Stagger Lee, it is Papa Legba, it is Ishu. It is that tall, lean man, dark man in the top hat,
yes,
who knows more about the dark in you than you do, and knows that you want it.
What I'd like to see, and what I think is going to, we're going to see more and more African writers from the continent,
that's right,
you know, writing Afrofuturist stories. And I think that the change that I've seen, because I've had a lot of interaction with especially Nigerian writers. And what I remember from maybe about 10 years ago, There was this general attitude of what is real literature, and science fiction and fantasy and speculative fiction were not considered real literature, and what was considered real literature were like Things Fall Apart, you know, serious writing without any of that weird stuff going on in it. But I think that we'll see more Africans directly from the continent writing this kind of literature, and I think that what they write is going to have like a different flavor as well. And what I also would like to see in terms of Afrofuturism is just more diversity in the types of writing. I'd like to see female writers, writers with disabilities, just more variety within Afrofuturist writing.
Right.
That's what I'm waiting to see, because right now it's so small. You know, and it's slowly building, and it's increasing and growing. But I'd like to see more of that, and I'd also like to see really an extremely successful Afrofuturist writer, extremely successful, as in like best selling status, who's mediocre.
Wow!
I want to see that. Yes.
Ice.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
All right.
Okay. I want to see that.
For me, the idea that genre fiction, and I usually say speculative fiction to cover everything as an umbrella term, but I think speculative fiction is really an easy way for a large population to find themselves and find their politics. Mm. Any kind of genre fiction, whether it's detective stories, whether it's cartoons, whether it's a romance, I know you find that hard to believe, but any kind of genre fiction can get away with telling a political story. And if it's a genre fiction, more different kinds of people are going to read it because they feel like, oh, this is just going to be fun. And then when they finish, they realize, oh wow, I thought about that. That was right. Deep. And whoa. And, you know, you saw Star Trek do it with issues around race. We see all kinds of TV speculative fiction shows introduce complex ideas. And I think the more of us who write and start writing younger, the more complex ideas we will put in genre fiction, and the more of us who will read them and become increasingly conscious of our political surroundings.
I hope it gives more people permission to know that they can imagine and that they can make stories. I mean, I think the three of us were at Astro Blackness a few months ago, and there was a young woman in the audience, black woman, who also loved horror and didn't think she could write it because she kept imagining black characters until she found an ARC, an advanced reading copy of one of Octavia Butler's novels on the streetcar or whatever they do in LA. Mm. And then it was like her imagination broke open and now she's writing. And it cuts to my heart that somebody thinks that because they've never seen it, they can't do it. So that's where I would hope it's going, is that more of us have just sort of know that we can stand up and make what we imagine.
You've been listening to writers Nalo Hopkinson, Nnedi Okorafor, and Jewel Gomez. A big thank you to the San Francisco Public Library for recording. For more information on Afrofuturist literature, follow the links at our website, radioproject.org. And we want to hear from you. What's your radical dream for the future? Have your say at radioproject.org, or join the conversation on Facebook, or Twitter at @making_contact, or Instagram at @makingcontactradioproject. Thanks for music from Anatech.